Welcome to Udemy Research from our Building a Micro School series by Valor Angles. Today, we are really diving into what I think is maybe the biggest, most frustrating challenge in alternative education right now is this massive gap between what we know works, you know, in the lab and the research, and what's actually happening on the ground in the classroom.
It really is the defining paradox, especially for the micro school movement. I mean, if you look at the academic meta-analyses, which are the most rigorous studies that pool together hundreds of other studies, the evidence for certain techniques is just staggering.
Staggering is the right word.
Take something like mastery learning. That's the system where a student only moves on once they've proven they've mastered a concept and they get all the help they need to get there. At the elementary level, that practice creates these monumental effect sizes. It's almost double what most other interventions can achieve.
And we should probably put a number on that because it's so big, it's almost hard to believe. We're talking about an effect size D value of nearly 1.0?
Yeah, around 0.94.
So to put that in perspective for you, that means you can take an average student, someone at the 50th percentile, and rocket them up to the 83rd or 84th percentile. That's a gain of more than 30 percentage points. It's a huge leap. In theory, it should be a guaranteed win.
And it doesn't stop there. If you pair that with high fidelity scaffolding, which is just that temporary supportive framework we build around a learner, you get another big bump in academic growth.
So the components are sound?
They're empirically, undeniably sound. Mastery, personalized pacing, targeted support, it all works.
Okay, so that's the theory. The foundation is rock solid. But here comes the cold water,
right?
The RAND Corporation. They published this incredibly rigorous independent analysis in November of 2025. They looked very closely at micro schools in the U.S. And after all that, despite the evidence for the components being so strong, what did they find?
They found, and I'm quoting here, negligible impacts on academic growth.
Negligible.
Yeah. Among the very, very small number of schools they could actually evaluate rigorously, but still negligible.
And that right there is the central tension we're diving into today. Why the disconnect? If the ingredients for success are scientifically proven, why did the gold standard of research from RAND find, well, almost nothing?
The research we've pulled together says the answer isn't in the philosophy, it's in the implementation. Quality of execution is, well, it's everything.
So our mission for this deep dive is to focus on a very specific, very high leverage moment in that execution. We're looking at the pivotal 6 to 9 year old transition. This is the period where a child is supposed to go from heavily guided, play-based learning to, well, to true self-direction.
And we have to move beyond just saying a school is self-directed. We need to look at how you systematically teach those self-management skills. It doesn't just happen.
To do that, we have to be using the same language, the same research language, because these terms get thrown around so loosely. Let's start with a big one, self-directed learning, or SDL.
Right. When academics talk about self-directed learning, or SDL, they're not talking about a kid just sitting quietly with a laptop. That's not it. They define it, really, in the tradition of Malcolm Knowles. It's about explicit executive function skills. For a student to be truly self-directed, they need to be able to do six things.
Six things, oh, okay.
They have to be able to define their own learning goals. They have to identify the resources they need. They have to figure out the structure, sequence the steps, and this is crucial, outline the assessment criteria. How will they know they succeeded?
And what's the last one?
They have to be able to locate and use mentor feedback when they get stuck.
So it's a skill set, a rigorous skill set that has to be taught, not just waited for.
Precisely. And that whole process really hinges on another key term, mastery-based progression.
Which we mentioned earlier, that huge effect size.
Exactly. It's a standards-based system. The student is competing against the standard, not against the clock or other students. They get whatever time, whatever help they need, and the only grade that matters is that final assessment that shows they got it.
That's the engine for those huge effects. And the support mechanism for that is scaffolding.
Correct. Scaffolding is temporary, it's diagnostic, and it's designed to fade away. It's the structured help that lets a student work in their zone of proximal development, or ZPD.
That's that sweet spot, right? Where they can do it with help, but not quite on their own yet.
Exactly. The whole point of scaffolding is to make itself obsolete.
And the goal of that scaffolded work, the ideal state you're trying to get the learner into, is productive struggle.
This might be the single most important concept for a guide in a micro school. Productive struggle, as defined back in 2007 by Hibbert and Grouse, is the effortful cognitive work. you know, the real thinking you do to make sense of something that isn't immediately obvious.
And it is not the same as being frustrated or giving up.
Not at all. It's totally distinct from despair. It's the zone where real cognitive grit gets built.
Mm.
If a guide can't create and maintain that state of productive struggle, the entire SDL model just, it falls apart.
Okay, so let's unpack this developmental window, ages 6 to 9. Why is this specific period, which basically covers kindergarten through third grade, so critical?
It's because you have this developmental leap forward happening at the same time as a crucial neurological deficit.
A leap and a deficit. Okay.
So this age group, they are naturally moving away from a world of guided play. They're starting to actively seek independence. You see clinical guidance from places like Banner Health confirming that between ages 6 and 8, kids get way better at self-control, at problem solving. They can cope with small frustrations much better than a 5-year-old can.
So they feel ready for it.
They feel ready for autonomy.
Yep.
But, and this is the big but, their brains are still structurally immature for sustained independence.
Right, the prefrontal cortex.
Exactly. The part of the brain for complex decision-making, sustained attention, impulse control, all the things you need for that 6-step definition of SDL we just talked about. It's still under construction. It won't be fully mature until their 20s.
So you've got this paradox.
You've got the self-direction paradox. A child who biologically wants independence but lacks the wiring to actually pull it off without constant responsive support.
Which means you have to teach it systematically. You can't just expect it to emerge.
You have to train it. And this connects directly to the idea of grit, which a lot of people think is just, you know, a fixed personality trait.
But the research on this age group says it's not fixed at all.
The evidence is really strong that grit is malleable. It can be shaped by the environment. There was a 2022 study by Sutter and colleagues on about 430 young kids, ages 3 to 6, and they found that perseverance, which is a key part of grit, just naturally increases a lot with age in those early years. The brain is trying to build those skills.
And if you look just a little bit older, we can actually intervene and build it even more.
Absolutely. The Allen et al. Study from 2019 showed that you can design educational interventions that successfully build grit in 9 and 10-year-olds. They even did an analysis and estimated that the heritability of perseverance of effort is surprisingly low, only about 37%.
Wait, so less than 40% of a child's grit is genetic?
That's what the data suggests.
So over 60% is environmental. That puts a huge responsibility on the environment a microschool creates.
It does. But that potential is only unlocked if you embrace what we can call the scaffolding imperative. Research from all over, including from the ASCD, is crystal clear on this. Self-directed learning skills will not just spontaneously appear. They require a school-wide systematic approach.
Starting with heavy teacher direction, and then slowly, intentionally, giving up control.
Intentionally is the key word. If the guide is inconsistent, or if the process isn't deliberate, the skill just stalls out.
So for that systematic approach to work, we have to talk about the gold standard of scaffolding.
Mm.
You mentioned the Vanderpoel framework from 2010, the 3 principles. Can we go deeper on that?
Of course. The 3 principles are contingency, fading, and transfer of responsibility. Contingency is the hardest one. It demands that the guide be responsive in real time. The support you give has to adapt immediately and exactly to the student's level of understanding in that very moment. You can't pre-plan it perfectly.
It sounds like the guide has to be kind of cognitive doctor, diagnosing and changing the dose of support minute by minute.
That's a great way to put it. Then you have fading, which is the gradual systematic removal of that support as the student gets more competent. And finally, transfer of responsibility is the handover, where the student fully owns the skill.
And these all work together through something called the contingent shift principle.
Yes. The contingent shift principle is the rule book for when to give more help or less help. If the student is failing, if they're floundering, you must increase your support, make it more explicit. But if they're succeeding, if they're showing mastery, you must immediately start to decrease the support. That responsiveness is the engine that drives the whole system.
It sounds great. But I have to ask about the flip side. What's the danger of over-scaffolding? If the guide is too helpful, don't you risk creating dependency?
That is the critical warning. Singh and colleagues noted this in 2020. Students who get too much scaffolding might look good in the short term, but they, and I quote, may suffer when it is taken away.
They become fragile.
Fragile and dependent on someone else telling them what to do. The goal is self-efficacy, not just compliance. We want the support to become obsolete.
And all of this complexity is happening within the reality of a microschool, which is the mixed-age classroom. So why do they group 6, 7, 8, and 9-year-olds together? Does the research actually back that up?
It's a great question. Historically, people saw it as just an administrative thing, maybe a necessary evil, but the research shows it's at the very least harmless academically and actually really beneficial for non-cognitive skills. Veenman's 1995 Best Evidence Synthesis, which is a classic, looked at over 50 studies. It found the median effect size for academic achievement was literally zero. ES equals 0.00.
So no academic harm. That in itself is a huge finding.
It is, especially when you look at the benefits. Veenman found a small but positive effect, an ES of plus 0.10, for things like attitude towards school, social adjustment, that kind of thing.
But the more recent, more powerful evidence comes from models that really lean into this structure, right?
Yeah.
Like high-fidelity Montessori.
Exactly. The Randolph et al. 2023 Campbell Systematic Review is the gold standard here. We're talking about a review of over 132,000 students. It focused on authentic Montessori environments, which always use these three-year age spans, and they found modest but still significant academic benefits, a positive correlation for math and general academics.
I think the biggest finding from that review, though, was the massive impact on executive function.
Oh, absolutely. The non-academic effects were incredibly strong, a large positive effect on what they called the inner experience of school, and another significant positive effect on executive function.
So the very structure of the microschool classroom, the mixed age grouping, is perfectly aligned with the goal of teaching SDL skills. It's building the cognitive architecture for it.
It is. It's improving the self-control, the planning, the goal setting that you need for self-direction.
But what's the actual mechanism there? It's not just osmosis from sitting next to an older kid.
The mechanism is peer tutoring. It's the learning by teaching effect. A 2025 meta-analysis confirms something really wild. The student who is acting as the tutor benefits as much, and sometimes more, than the student getting the help.
Wow.
Yeah, the tutors saw an effect size of G equals 0.39, while the two T's were at G equals a 0.33.
So that's where the magic is. The 9-year-old has to consolidate their own knowledge, explain it clearly, find the gaps in their own thinking. They're developing metacognition, which is the hallmark of real mastery.
It creates this constant organic feedback loop in the classroom. The mixed age group turns an operational challenge into a powerful feature.
Okay, let's recap this first section. The developmental window from 6 to 9 is perfect for teaching self-directed learning. The methods, like mastery and scaffolding, have massive effect sizes behind them, and the structure, the mixed age group, boosts executive function through peer tutoring. The theory is airtight.
It is.
And yet we still have the and finding, negligible academic impact across the sector. So this forces the really tough question. If the theory is so solid, where exactly does the execution break down?
To understand the breakdown, you have to look at the human element, the curriculum, the software. Those are just tools. The difference between a school that succeeds and one that fails often comes down entirely to the guide's responsiveness. And that brings us to the famous Mrs. Lewis effect. This is from a study by Martin and colleagues in 2018.
Remind us of the setup for this one, because I think it perfectly illustrates the challenge microschools are facing.
So the study compared two teachers, Mrs. Lewis and Mr. Green. They were both given an identical structured curriculum designed to fade its own support over time. It was supposed to be teacher-proof. But when the curriculum materials got to the point where the support was minimal, the student outcomes just dead. They diverged radically.
And the results were not subtle.
Not at all. Mrs. Lewis's students maintained high performance. They were independent. But Mr. Green's students, their performance saw this massive, statistically significant decline as soon as the materials' built-in support faded away. They couldn't do it on their own.
So if the materials were identical, what was Mrs. Lewis doing differently? This is the critical piece of advice for anyone listening.
It boiled down to two major observable behaviors, and they both have to do with responsiveness and just being present. First, Mrs. Lewis spent 52.6% of her time on whole class monitoring during independent work. She was actively circulating, observing, diagnosing for more than half the period.
And Mr. Green?
Mr. Green was only at 31.3%.
That 50% monitoring standard is huge. We often think of independent work time as the moment the guide gets to catch up on email or plan the next lesson. This research says that's actually the guide's most intense time.
It's the most intense diagnostic time. And the second key difference was how they intervened. Mrs. Lewis extended the materials beyond their intended purpose almost 45% of the time.
What does that mean, extended the materials?
It means she would see a student struggling, and instead of just repeating what was in the book, she'd offer a new analogy, or connect it to a different concept, or give them a novel challenge. She customized the support in the moment.
And Mr. Green, I assume, did not.
Mr. Green mostly just provided static support. He'd repeat the instructions already in the materials. He was relying on the curriculum to do the scaffolding by itself.
So the huge insight here is that curriculum cannot scaffold independently.
That's it. Any micro school that relies only on adaptive software or work packets without a guide hitting that 50%+ monitoring standard is setting itself up for the same fate as Mr. Green's class. Dependence, followed by a performance collapse when the training wheels come off.
That sets such a high bar for the guide. It means they're constantly walking this tightrope between being helpful and creating dependence. And that brings us back to the struggle zone. How does a guide actually operationalize difficulty in a room with a 3-year age span? They need to know instantly if a kid is in productive struggle or just unproductive despair.
That ability to diagnose the difference is exactly what separates Mrs. Lewis from Mr. Green. Productive struggle is the learning zone. Despair and frustration, on the other hand, they shut down the prefrontal cortex, they trigger a fight-or-flight response, and learning becomes impossible.
And there's a tool for this, right? The 0 to 10 frustration scale.
Yes, and this should be explicitly taught to every guide, and honestly to the students themselves. Level 0 to 3 is the happy zone. The work's too easy, you need more challenge. Level 4 to 6 is the sweet spot. That's the zone of productive struggle. Effort is being applied, mistakes are being made, coping skills are being tested. That is the optimal state for learning.
And then you hit the danger zone.
Level 7 to 10, that's the overwhelm zone. The cognitive load is too high. You're going to see anxiety, avoidance, or an emotional meltdown. If a student is at a 7 or higher, the guide's first job is de-escalation, not teaching. You cannot teach a dysregulated child new content.
So the trick is recognizing those levels in real time. A 9-year-old might internalize it, while a 6-year-old might just throw a pencil. What are the key behavioral signs of a student in that optimal 4 to 6 zone?
A student in productive struggle is engaged, they're curious, even if they're frowning. You'll see them trying different strategies, self-correcting small mistakes, going back to the source material. Their language is strategic. They might say, wait, let me try this other way, or I think I missed a step.
And their requests for help are specific.
Exactly. It's a laser-focused question about one little barrier, not a general, I don't get it.
And the red flags for unproductive frustration.
That's when you see anxiety or avoidance. The student might slump in their chair or freeze. Or just keep trying the same failed method over and over. You'll hear defeatist language like, I can't do this, I'm just bad at math. That's a statement about their identity, not a request for help.
And that's when the guide has to step in, but not with an answer.
Never with an answer. But first, you have to use the 5-minute rule. Make sure the student has put in at least 5 minutes of genuine effort before you intervene. You have to let them build that grit muscle.
And when you do step in,
the goal is always just to nudge them back into that 4 to 6 zone with probing questions. If you just tell them the next step, you short-circuit their thinking, and you teach them to be dependent, you've stolen the learning opportunity from them.
The theory is great, but a 2024 study from Young and colleagues pointed out that actually operationalizing this is really inconsistent across the field. There's no consensus on what productive struggle even looks like.
And that is the core implementation challenge. It requires scenario-based training for guides, video observation, a shared language. You need to be able to say, if you see behaviors A, B, and C, your response must be D, E, and F. Mm-hmm. Without that high-fidelity training, the Mrs. Lewis standard is just. It's unattainable for most people.
Okay, let's switch gears a bit to the logistics of the classroom. How do you manage the huge range of abilities in a 6 to 9 group? If a micro school just uses heterogeneous grouping all day, are they sacrificing academic growth?
It depends entirely on whether that grouping is flexible or permanent. A meta-analysis from Liu and colleagues in 1996 gave us really clear directions on this. Low-ability students benefit most from heterogeneous or mixed-ability groups. They get to see high-level modeling and language from their peers. Average-ability students, though, they benefit most from homogeneous or same-ability grouping for targeted instruction. And high-ability students, they don't show a significant difference either way.
So permanent tracking, where kids are just stuck in one group all year, actually hurts the average student. They have to choose between social integration and academic acceleration.
It hurts everyone in the long run. The key is flexible grouping. And the research from Slavin back in 1987 gave us a great model for this, the Joplin plan. The insight is that ability grouping works best when it's temporary and subject specific.
Can you break down the Joplin plan for us?
Yeah. The Joplin plan, which was first studied for reading, involves cross-grade grouping. So a 6-year-old and a 9-year-old might be in the same group, but only for reading. They're grouped by their specific skill level, say everyone working on fractions.
And just for a specific block of time?
Right, for that dedicated academic block. The rest of the day, they go back to their mixed-age, heterogeneous homeroom for projects, collaborations, social learning.
So you get the best of both worlds. You get the social and executive function benefits of mixed ages, and you also get the targeted academic punch, which had a strong effect size of ES equals plus 0.45.
That flexibility is the secret. It's the mechanism that lets a micro school chase that huge D 0.94 for mastery learning without giving up the non-cognitive gains from the mixed age structure.
So it all sounds very sophisticated. But we have to come back to the RAND reality check. That 2025 finding of negligible academic impacts can't just be brushed aside.
No, it's paramount. It tells us that while the underlying science is sound, the sector as a whole, the 99.9% of it that RAND couldn't even evaluate, is probably failing to implement these systems with any kind of fidelity. We have a massive credibility gap.
So what are the main reasons for that failure?
I think there are three. First, the huge variability in guide performance, and the difference between a Mrs. Lewis and a Mr. Green. Second, the lack of robust standardized measurement systems. Too many micro schools use anecdotes instead of real data like RIT scores, which makes it impossible to verify growth. And third, they just fail to translate the philosophy of self-direction into rigorous daily operational practices. They adopt the mission statement, but not the systems needed to actually achieve it.
So understanding what should work is one thing, but running a micro school is about what happens when 12 kids ages 6 to 9 show up on a Monday morning. We need to move from the theory to the concrete systems.
Exactly. We need structure because real independence is actually built on a foundation of routine. And we see this in the most successful operational models.
Let's start with a really common one. Prenda. They use a system called the 4-mode day.
Prenda's structure, which is about 4 or 5 hours a day, 4 days a week, is all about separating the different functions of learning.
Can you walk us through those 4 modes and why that separation matters so much for self-direction?
The day starts with connect. This is all about community building, values, social emotional alignment. It gets the group ready to work together and leverage that peer tutoring later on. Then you hit the most critical part of the day, conquer. This is the independent, personalized, mastery-based academic time. This is where the guide uses that Joplin plan logic, focusing on targeted skill groups.
And that separation is key. The guide knows that from, say, 9:30 to noon, their only job is diagnosis and targeted scaffolding. That's when they have to hit that 50% monitoring standard.
Exactly. Their attention isn't divided. After conquer comes collaborate, which is more inquiry-led, social problem-solving in mixed groups. And finally, create, which is hands-on project work where students apply the skills they mastered in conquer.
That routine seems like the ultimate scaffold for a 6 to 9-year-old brain. But what about the economics? How can one guide handle 8 to 15 kids and monitor 50% of the time?
That's where the model has to trade one cost for another. Instead of paying for a high-cost certified teacher, the model invests in high-cost external support systems. So the Prenda model, for example, emphasizes external coaching and centralized professional development for its guides. They're substituting the traditional salary overhead for high-quality vendor support and specialized training.
And there's a more tech-forward version of this, right? The Alpha School approach.
Right. Alpha School uses what they call compressed academics. They leverage really high-quality AI tutors and adaptive software to deliver all the core academics in about 2 intense hours in the morning.
And that efficiency frees up the rest of the day.
It frees up the entire afternoon for workshops, labs, deep dive projects. The guide in that model acts more like a floor mentor, making sure the tech is working, while the AI manages the personalized learning path.
So the trade-off is clear. Less daily human intervention on core subjects, but a huge reliance on expensive, high-quality educational technology.
Precisely. And both of these models, and any successful model, depend on one more thing. Moving beyond grade levels and using rigorous, vertically scaled measurement.
Can you break that down for someone building a program right now? Why is giving a standard second grade test to an 8-year-old in this model just broken?
It's broken because grade-level tests are designed to measure proficiency at one single point in time against one single age group. If you have an 8-year-old who's reading at a 5th grade level, that 2nd grade test tells you absolutely nothing useful about what they need to learn next. A mastery system requires a vertically scaled measure, something that can track progress along a continuous developmental scale from age 5 all the way up to age 18.
And what are the gold standards for that?
The recommended gold standard is MAP growth from NWEA. It uses the RIT scale, which runs from about 140 to 300. The key thing about the RIT scale is that it's an interval scale. The distance between points is consistent, so you can measure true year-over-year growth no matter the student's age.
And the data isn't just for a report card. It actually drives the instruction.
Yes. NWEA's system has a feature called instructional connections. It instantly links a student's RIT score to over 40 different compatible learning tools. So the assessment literally becomes the assignment. It automatically generates the student's next step.
And the other big player is iReady.
Correct. The iReady diagnostic uses a different scale, 100 to 800, but it's very powerful because it combines the diagnostic test with its own integrated instructional content. It streamlines the whole mastery cycle, which is a great option for a micro school.
And what about communicating with parents? They're used to seeing A's and B's. How do you manage that?
With transparency. You have to shift the conversation from how did my child rank to how much did my child grow? You have to use recognized scales like the MAP-RIT score, show them the percentile ranks, and clearly graph the growth over time. And then you pair that hard data with portfolio artifacts from the Create block to show how the skills are being applied. You have to move beyond just testimonials.
Okay, let's distill all of this down into daily practice. If I'm a guide with 15 kids, ages 6 to 9, what are the 5 non-negotiable protocols I have to master to be a Mrs. Lewis and not a Mr. Green?
Okay, these are the 5 daily operational habits. Protocol number 1, the contingent shift response. This is how you apply scaffolding in real time. When you're monitoring for at least 50% of the time and you see a student is stuck, you have to use a specific progression of support.
Okay, walk me through it. A 7-year-old is stuck on a 2-digit addition problem.
You start with a question to check their understanding. What does this number 25 actually represent? If they can answer that, you move to a prompt. Remember the 10 sticks we used yesterday? How could that help? If they're still stuck, you offer a concrete cue. Look at the corner of your desk. You drew 2 10s and 5 1s. Can you use that drawing?
So you're pushing them back to a tool they already have.
Exactly. You're narrowing the search space for them. And only if the question, the prompt, and the cue all fail do you offer a direct explanation. This forces them to keep ownership of the thinking.
That takes incredible discipline.
Yeah.
Okay, protocol 2, the 4 to 6 frustration calibration.
This is the emotional intelligence piece. The guide has to be an expert in recognizing that 0 to 10 scale. You teach the students to name where they are on the scale, and you use that 5-minute rule before stepping in. If a student says they're at a 7 or higher, the intervention is never about the math problem. It's about deep breathing, taking a break, switching to a less stressful task. You de-escalate first, always.
Got it. Protocol 3, cross-age tutoring structure.
This can't be random. It has to be scheduled. You use the Joplin plan logic.
Right.
During the Conquer block, you use targeted ability groups. So the 9-year-old who has mastered fractions is intentionally paired with a 6-year-old who's just starting to understand them. But for the rest of the day, during Collaborate and Create, you make sure the groups are mixed and heterogeneous to keep those strong social and non-academic benefits.
Okay. Protocol 4. The mastery assessment cycle.
This is what makes your data is actually driving instruction. You use MAP or iReady 2 or 3 times a year to get that baseline. That data feeds the personalized learning path. All the little checks for understanding along the way are ungraded. They're just feedback. Grades are only for the final big summative assessment that proves mastery.
That's how you ensure you're actually getting that D0.94 effect.
It is.
And finally, the moment of truth. Protocol 5. Readiness indicators for fading. When do you stop helping?
You only fade support when you have verified 5 specific indicators of deep understanding. You have to see, first, CASC accuracy without your help. 2nd, explanation quality. Can they explain the why? 3rd, transfer capability. Can they apply it to a new problem? 4th, self-correction. Can they find and fix their own mistakes?
And the 5th?
Metacognitive awareness. Can they tell you the strategy they use to solve the problem? If you don't see all 5, it's too soon to fade the support. You'll create that dependency we talked about.
These 5 protocols, they paint a picture of a guide who is less of a traditional teacher and more of a a highly skilled behavioral and academic diagnostician.
That's a perfect description.
Which brings us back to the economic and regulatory realities. How is one guide supposed to do all this for 8 to 15 kids, especially if they don't have a traditional teaching license?
It's only possible if the model shifts its costs strategically. That 1 to 15 ratio only works if you have mature systems and high-quality adaptive tech. But you have to fill the expertise gap. So a model like Prenda substitutes the high salary of a certified teacher with intensive external support. Constant coaching for the guide, professional development. The vendor or network has to provide that support structure.
And where does the money come from?
Viability usually requires tapping into public funds through education savings accounts or ESAs, or a charter partnership. Otherwise, you're looking at tuition in the $8,000 to $15,000 plus range.
And then there are the regulatory hurdles, state laws about age grade requirements.
Absolutely. The traditional regulatory system is often in direct conflict with a flexible, mixed-age, mastery-based model. That's why so many successful micro-schools have to operate under private school, charter, or homeschool frameworks.
But some states are starting to adapt.
Yes, states with strong ESA programs are leading the way. Utah, for example, passed a bill in 2024 that explicitly amended zoning laws to allow home-based micro-schools. Crucially, it also prohibited local school boards from requiring specific credentials or forcing state tests on those schools. We're seeing similar moves in places like West Virginia and Georgia. They're recognizing that you can't regulate a 12-student learning pod the same way you regulate a 1,200-student public school.
So, to bring this all together and connect it back to that RAND finding, the evidence supports the mechanisms, mastery learning, scaffolding, peer tutoring, but it doesn't endorse any specific brand or software.
Precisely. The Mrs. Lewis study is the ultimate cautionary tale. The materials don't matter nearly as much as the responsiveness of the human guide in the room. And the RAND finding just confirms that the sector as a whole lacks the shared infrastructure to verify its own claims. We can't say for sure that Microschool X is delivering that D0.94 effect until they're implementing these protocols with fidelity and measuring growth transparently on a real vertically scaled assessment.
We opened with this paradox. These monumental effect sizes in the lab, and then the RAND Corporation finds negligible impacts in the field.
And the research gives us the answer. It's all about operational execution. Self-directed learning for a seven-year-old is not a developmental impossibility. The component practices work. The developmental window is perfect. But the successful microschools aren't defined by their philosophy of autonomy. They're defined by their systems of disciplined execution. The Mrs. Lewis 50% monitoring standard, the 4-6 frustration calibration, structured peer tutoring, and the non-negotiable use of transparent assessment systems like MAP or iReady.
So the next evolution for the microschool movement isn't about coming up with a better philosophy. It's about proving the outcomes with better shared data-driven operations.
The component practices are proven to work. The challenge now for the entire sector is to move beyond testimonials and build the verifiable research infrastructure needed to prove those outcomes to the 99.9% of the sector that RAND couldn't even look at. Until that happens, the skepticism is entirely warranted.
A challenging, but I think a very necessary call to action for anyone building one of these schools.
Indeed.
Find full research and sources at research.yuda.me, that's Yuda.me.